And it's in 3, 2, 1.
Got the motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure. And whatever comes our way. Yeah, I got to go make it happen. Take the world in a loving embrace. Fire all of your guns at once and
hello and welcome to Beyond the Ordinary Webcast Radio, where we bring you an interesting guest, a new experience, a different angle on life. I'm Nancy Lorenz with my co-host, Elena Young.
And our guest is author Derek Jensen. Derek Jensen joined us when we were broadcasting in Monterey, California, and we were so delighted. We liked him so much, and if you listen to his archive programs, you will know why. So we are very happy that he has joined us again. Hi, Derek.
Hey, how you doing?
We are great. And you?
I'm doing well.
Good. One of the things that impressed us the most is the way you speak about paradoxes and people's thinking. And by the way, for listeners who, for the first time, they've heard of Derek, they can go back to our website, to his page, beyondtheordinary.net, and hear our previous broadcasts with him. They are just extraordinary. Lots of food for thought. Anyway, you bring a very different perspective to any subject you contemplate or research. How is it that you see these things so clearly?
It's because I've had the luxury of having had a lot of time to just sort of sit and think and listen. You know, I used to have on the door to the room where I would work when I lived in Spokane, I used to have a little handwritten sign there that said, "Don't think, listen." And I really like that. And the only reason I don't have that now is because where I live now, I don't have a door on the room where I work. And I think a lot of it has to do with just sitting down and having the luxury to listen to myself, to listen to what I want, to listen to humans in my life, to listen to non-humans in my life. And that, I mean, in some ways it's not a luxury. It's probably the most important thing in one's life, but the truth is that I haven't. My first degree, as you remember, was a BS in mineral engineering physics with an emphasis in BS. I knew right away that I didn't want to get a 40-hour job. I couldn't bear the thought of, you know, sort of waking up when I'm 65 and realizing that I spent my life doing something I didn't want to do. And so I worked very, very hard, actually, to extricate myself from the wage economy. And that has given me, you know, sort of boundless time to figure out, you know, what I want to do, to just listen, to think about stuff. But once you start thinking about it, it's pretty obvious. I mean, it's like a friend of mine says, that a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground and end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. Because once you start asking the questions, they really lead pretty clearly to, you know, sort of these inescapable conclusions. The same with people who work on race issues, with gender issues. A lot of that, we keep coming back to, you know, sort of the same cause. And it's like a friend of mine says that I was... in a car, I don't know if I said this on one of the other interviews with you, but I love this exchange. So I was riding around in a car with a friend of mine years ago, an environmental activist, George Drafin, and I said, "So if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be?" And I was just, you know, shooting the breeze as we're stuck in traffic. And he said, "That's a really stupid question, Derek, because we can fantasize whatever we want, but the only level of technology that's sustainable is the Stone Age." And, I mean, of course he's right, that the only... I mean, if you think about it for a second, if you're using any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources, it can't last because you're going to run out.
Sure.
And it's just so obvious. Or another really good one is that years and years and years ago, I interviewed John Livingston, who wrote this great book called The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation. And one of the things that he introduced me to was that natural selection might not be based on competition. And at the time when I interviewed him, it's like, you know, sorry, you're just getting old and senile and this is crazy. But that was probably about 10 years ago. And the more I've thought about it, the more I've, I mean, you don't even have to think about it. It's just so obvious to me that natural selection cannot be based on competition. It's just ridiculous to think it is, actually, even though that's what I'd thought unquestioningly for the first, 30 years of my life, or 32 or whatever. And it's just so obvious that it's based on cooperation, because if you hyper-exploit your surroundings, you're going to deplete them. I mean, the creatures who survive in the long run survive in the long run, and you survive in the long run by improving your own habitat. So by cooperating with your habitat is how you survive. So it's not like I, was born just going, pretty much everything we've taught is a bunch of crap, or we've been taught is a bunch of crap. Instead, I mean, it took me, there's this great line I heard somebody say maybe 15 years ago, or actually I read it somewhere, which is that it takes somebody 10 years to change their mind. And I really like that. I mean, that's what happened with the whole evolution thing. It took me maybe 5 years that, John Livingston says this, and it's like, oh, you're so silly. And then 4 or 5 years later, it's like, he's really right.
Well, that's what knowledge does for you. It expands your mind.
Yeah, and it usually takes a long time to do so. And that's where we come back to the original thing I was calling a luxury, which is, if I was working 60 hours a week and then coming home to the demands of a large family or something, it would be very, very difficult for me to even be able to consider whether evolution is based on competition or cooperation or what. I would just be wanting to grab something to eat and veg out for a couple hours and go to bed and get up and do it again, which is a really crazy way to live.
Well, I think there's another aspect of this that enables you to think and write as you do, is that you did have a pretty traumatic or horrendous childhood, but instead of staying mired in the past with that, you gained wisdom from it. You began to understand the lowest levels of humanity, and that, coupled with your ability to communicate with the natural elements, with animals, with the stars, probably prepared you to be able to deal with everything and then do what you are doing now, which is making people think about the things they don't want to think about, but bringing those things out of the shadows, which is where they proliferate, is a tremendous thing for humanity. So all of that together, I think you are just amazingly prepared to be doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you. There's this beautiful, I actually don't like a lot of the Greek philosophers, but there's this great thing I think comes out of Plato about the notion of what's supposed to happen is after you die, that might be Aristotle, I don't know, it's one of those dead guys. after you die, you are treated for 100 lifetimes the way you treated people here on Earth. And then you are given, then when it's time for you to come back, you're given a specific task. And then right before you're born, you drink this elixir of forgetfulness. And it's your job when you're here to try to remember and fulfill that task. And you will have guiding forces who will help you along the way. Daemons, they called them, D-A-I-M-O-N, and thus, oh gosh, I think it was Aristotle, said that the point of life was, and I'm going to mispronounce this word, but I think it's eudaimonia, E-U-D-A-I-M-O-N-I-A, which literally means, some people translate it as happiness, but it's much better to translate it as fittingness. And what it literally means is having good daemons, having good leaders. And the point is that if those things in your life can lead you to being who you are, that's what it's really about, is living the life that is yours to live and living the life that you should be living, finding out who you are, what it was. I've got this friend, and I'm going to use a mechanical metaphor I don't really like here, but I've got this old friend who always said that he was hardwired to be an engineer because he just loved doing designs. I mean, it was kind of a scam because he was getting paid to do it, but, I mean, what the companies didn't know is that he would have paid them to go in and mess around with drafting tools and design these systems. And it's kind of the same. You know, that's one of the most important questions I think we can ask. When I used to teach at a university, it was something that we addressed the whole quarter was, so what, you know, who are you? And what are you meant to be doing? What do you want to do? What is it that you just love doing? And for me, this is part of it. And how this relates to the question of, you know, this, I always thought, you know, with as much as I write about really difficult or horrifying materials, I had this friend years and years ago who sometimes accused me of being morbid because I deal with so much of this stuff. And that never sat right with me, and it frankly disturbed me quite a lot. But then a few years ago, I was at this conference, and afterwards, the woman who ran the conference, Carolyn Raffensperger, is this amazingly wonderful human being, went around the group thanking each one of us for the gifts that we had brought. And it was a different thanks that she gave to each person. When she came to me, she said that, I have stared evil in the face and not lost the capacity to love. And that's given me, for whatever reason, the ability to take in a lot more horrors than most people and to not have it destroy me, but instead to be able to metabolize it and turn it back into a gift to the culture, or not to the culture, but a gift to the community. And that made me feel really good, and that helped me to no longer question whether, you know, I'm just morbid or something, or whether, because it is, for whatever reason, I have this capacity to look at this stuff. And yeah, I go to the library, and, you know, I do the research, and I can't tell you how many hours I've spent sobbing in the stacks of libraries as I read about, you know, the horrors of child labor or of ecocide or whatever. I mean, I cry a lot, but then, and it can stay with me, and it can tear me up a little, but it doesn't tear me up a lot. I mean, there are some things that when I take them in, they do really disturb me a lot. I mean, I can't watch, for example, there are a lot of movies I can't watch because the violence is so gratuitous and pointless, and or especially something that I cannot watch are this happens quite often in movies where there's a rape scene in which the woman is pushing the attacker away and then puts her hands behind him to pull him closer. That sort of patriarchal fantasy. And so there are some horrors that are really, really difficult for me to take in. But on the larger scale, that is something that I'm capable of doing.
Well, it seems to me, Derek, that you're looking at everything very realistically. And most people do not do that. And so they will call a person that does that being morbid because they don't want to face the fact of what goes on. And when what you were just saying struck me that, you know, you don't go to those movies, but in fact, it's probably true that people that when we do go to those movies, that is being morbid.
Well, it's a really interesting thing that, you know, language older than words was sometimes talked about as being a fairly violent book, but the body count in that book is actually fairly low. I mean, it's probably lower than your basic cop movie. And what I realized is that the difference was that when you attach meaning to the violence, it becomes infinitely more powerful. That it's not the blood on the page by itself that really hits people. It's the fact that I'm attaching a context to it. It's like I was watching the other night, I was at my mom's house and watching the movie Minority Report, which there was some parts that were okay and some parts that weren't okay. But there was one thing that really bugged me a lot, which is there's a scene where Tom Cruise and this other guy are fighting and they're flying through the air as they're fighting. And at one point, they hit this scaffolding that has three construction workers on it. And they fall. And we never see them hit the ground. It's like three or four stories up. And that's it. And then they go on, you know, we're supposed to be caring about Tom Cruise getting away from the bad guy there. But it's like, wait a second, those three people just died. And they were so insignificant that all we do is see them fall. We don't even see them hit the ground. We don't know that they've got families. We don't know any of this stuff. And so it's that sort of, I find that sort of cavalier, what's the word I'm looking for? Superficial. I find that superficial is the word. I find that sort of superficial approach to violence infinitely more disturbing than, I mean, I don't have a problem with violence in movies or in real life for that matter. It's just, let's attach meaning to it. Let's look at what it really means. Let's, if you're going to have some violence, we got to talk about the effects of it. And I mean, I need to be clear, I'm not a pacifist at all, but it's like, let's really examine the ramifications.
Sure. In that clip that you spoke about, it's putting human life on the same level as the hundreds of cars that are destroyed and all the chases and
right.
Yeah,
amazing
no value.
Things. There's absolutely no value. Yeah.
This is bad. This is not good programming for people, because I think that goes into the subconscious, and
yep.
most people probably don't even notice that.
Yep. Well, shoot, you know, 15 years ago, I wouldn't have. And that comes back to this whole question of starting to sort of wake up to this stuff and take the time to be able to do it. And, of course, there have been a lot of writers and people I've talked to, interviews I've done. I mean, interviews where I've interviewed people that have helped me to get to be able to see it. But when I was a teenager, you know, I like to shoot 'em up movies as much as the next person. I mean, once again, I wasn't sort of born with this abhorrence. Or maybe I was born with the abhorrence, and then it got taken out of me when I was a kid, and then it came back.
To being a kid, the way you spoke about it in a language older than words is what you used to do when you looked out at the sky. Why don't you tell us some about that?
Well, actually, I had something happen. I received this gift just like 2 weeks ago that I really want to talk about that has to do with this whole sort of connection to nature thing. So I live right next to a pond, and I was out just sitting by the pond, maybe, I don't know, 10 o'clock one morning, and I saw this muddy bug crawling up from the edge. I didn't actually see it come out of the water, but it was very clear it had been in the mud, and very, very muddy. And I've seen these types of bugs before, and insects, and I'd also seen their empty skins, excuse me, but I didn't know who they became. Empty skins, you know, when they leave it and fly out or whatever, crawl out. So I just watched, and it crawled up this blade of grass. Excuse me, I'm going to take the phone away and cough for a second. Excuse me.
Well,
anyway.
Derek, that brings us to a break in any event.
Okay.
So we'll take a pause and you can cough and we'll be back. This is Beyond the Ordinary with Nancy and Lena. Our guest is author Derek Jensen, and we will return right after this.
Mechanics is a supreme law, and a shocking, radical law it is. The law is your attitude affects everything in your life.
Grandpa School of Enlightenment is a phenomenal, extraordinary place to learn about the nature of ourselves and the meaning of our existence. This is not just more philosophy. This is a place where you can experience the knowledge you learn and know the truth for yourself. Learn more at Ramtha.com. View A Look Within Ramtha School of Enlightenment, a short independently produced video giving a brief synopsis of what you can expect. Beginner's information packets and details can also be found at Ramtha.com.
Here is Rantha speaking to his students.
That the greatest school of thought would give you all of the reason for being here, take every one of your lives individually and show you the science of being alive and how it works. Then take the soul and indeed its reason for being here and understand it in the light of all that knowledge. Make known the unknown. So then there is no confusion, as much as you want to make it so. Indeed, there is no confusion in these teachings. There never has been, because it is the truth. That everyone here is equipped inseparably with God.
Rantha's School of Enlightenment is not a cult. There is no guru. Rantha.com. Every Wednesday is a special broadcast day where we have unscheduled impromptu programs. Rantha teachings, many being several hours long, will be broadcast in part.
These teachings will not be archived. However, the audio tapes are available at Rantha.com or linked directly from our audio by month pages at BeyondTheOrdinary.net. These teachings are broadcast with the permission of JZK Incorporated.
Coming soon, talks with J.C. Knight.
BeyondTheOrdinary.net.
MJV Spring products are created and designed to enrich and nurture people's lives with meaning, as reflected by ancient and mystical symbols innate in all humanity. These meaningful symbols adorn golf shirts, sweatshirts, t-shirts, and baseball caps, as well as caftans, coffee mugs, greeting cards, and sultan's pillows. You can easily recognize MJV Spring products by their beautiful ancient symbol designs and excellent quality. The designs include the mystical seven-pointed star, the wings of Isis, the eye of Horus, the magical unicorn, and more. Shop from anywhere in the world at mjvspring.com. MJV Spring is without doubt beyond the ordinary.
This is Beyond the Ordinary Webcast Radio with Nancy and Elena and our guest, Derek Jensen. He is author of Listening to the Land, A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, and coming out this summer, Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests. We want to tell you also that available only from Derek, if you go to his website and you can get to that through his page on our website. You can order some of these books. You'll get them autographed and at a really good price, as well as his CD, Stand Up Tragedy, which I think that title is great. And something else, the anthology, The X-Files. It's centered all around the subject of ex-girlfriends or ex-boyfriends, The X-Files. I like that. So we're back, and you were telling us, Derek, about this little insect covered with mud.
Mm-hmm. So it crawled up to the about three-quarters of the way up this piece of grass, and I just sat there watching, and it took about... probably a couple, three, 4 hours for it to emerge. And I didn't know that I was going to be sitting there for the next few hours. I was just watching, you know, I'd watch for 5 minutes and then, okay, I'm going to watch for five more minutes and see what happens next, and then mm-hmm. five more. And a little hump appeared, and then on its back, and then its head emerged, and then make a long story short, it then unfolded into a very, very, very big dragonfly. And I'm sitting there the whole time, and I'm thinking, I should take pictures. And then I just kept sort of hearing this impulse, no, no, no. And then only when the wings were entirely unfurled and then straightened out, I got this impulse again saying, okay, now you can take a picture. And it was kind of like, you know, this, you know, I'm not dressed yet. And and then so I go down to my mom's and I eat, fully expecting to be gone when I get back, but it's still there. And then I go to bed that night and get up the next day, and I walk out there fully expecting once again it to be gone, and it's still there. And it's still there. I walk up, I stop and look at it standing, and then I'm standing, and then I look at my feet, and because there's tons of little frogs out there, I want to make sure I'm not standing on one. If I shift, I won't step on one. And then when I look back to it, it's gone. And it was just so clear that it had waited, you know. And I mean, what are the odds of it flying? You know, if it's, you could say, well, it was just sunning until it was warm enough to fly. But it was literally, you know, 10 seconds or 5 seconds after I arrived there, and then it flew up around and flew in circles around the pond for a while, and then circled higher up in the air, and then went over the trees and. I think I saw it again later in the day, but I don't know if that was that one or a different one. And it was just a really...
It definitely was a gift.
Yeah.
Because they don't hang around that long after the metamorphosis.
Oh, don't they?
No, it waited for you.
Yeah. And that's... I think that those gifts happen... all the time. So I live here in Northern California and in a redwood forest, and at first I basically sort of felt like a good Nazi here, you know, because I'm a nice guy, but I'm still a member of the dominant culture that's killing the planet. And that all shifted. I don't know if I mentioned this before, but it's a kind of a wonderful story, I think, that all shifted when I just kept getting the impulse. They don't actually go off in the forest all that much because it's really thick forest, and it's really fun to go back there. But it's a lot of game trails where you crawl, which is fun. But I don't do it as often as I should. Anyway, so I'm getting this impulse. I need to go to this one part of the forest, and so finally I do, and I see that somebody's been cutting burls off the redwood trees, and so there's all sorts. It's fairly fresh. A lot of sawdust on the ground. And I find a saw in there, and then I see different footprints on the path that goes between here and my mom's house, and I keep looking, and eventually there's a branch. You could say, well, you know, I spied something out, but the truth is that this branch sort of presented itself to me, that there was a branch that was broken at a level that was too high for any game, so for any wildlife. So I followed that, and I eventually found this guy sitting there smoking a cigarette. And I said, I'm sorry, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm just passing through. And I said, well, it'd be okay if you were passing through, except somebody's been cutting burls, and that makes me really nervous. And he said, well, I don't even have a saw. I said, well, that's because I found your saw yesterday. I didn't say it. I just thought it. And then I walked him off. You know, it's sort of weird. I'm against private property, except, of course, when it's mine. but this was a little bit different, of course, because I wouldn't have minded so much if he would have just been walking through and enjoying it. But he was, like I said, cutting burls. And the point of all this is that he came back again, and I walked him off again. And it was all, that marked a huge transition in me feeling like I live here, because the next 3 or 4 days after that happened, I saw the biggest pile of bear poop I've ever seen. I saw the biggest red-legged frog I've ever seen. And then on the third day, there was this bird flew out of the underbrush and brushed its wing against my chest. And it was so clear to me that the land was saying thank you for this. And ever since then, I felt like I've been not an occupier, but a little bit more. I mean, it would take 50 generations for me to really be here in this home, but more and more, it's like, you know, we are together. And that actually brings up something else I've been thinking about a lot, is there's a lot of Himalayan blackberries here and a lot of Scotch broom. And I've been pulling the Scotch broom and cutting back Himalayan blackberries a lot, but I still have some problems with it, in part because, if you know, of course they're invasive exotics, but, you know, if we really wanted to get rid of the most destructive invasive exotics, it'd be Homo domesticus, you know, the civilized people. But I'm not willing to go that far yet. But the point is, I don't know. I mean, I know that the Himalayan blackberry also gets crowded out by the trees when they get big enough. So are the blackberries actually preparing the soil for something else? I mean, should I just sort of let it run its course, or should I take them out? And I know that when I cut back on them too much, that some of the migratory songbirds start yelling at me because they live in there. So what I've been doing so far is cutting it back slow. Well, truth is, I'm cutting it back more slow than it's growing, but I'm cutting it back some. But here's something that occurred to me a couple days ago, that I was reading this thing about, you know, Indians managing the landscape, and management is a really nasty word, and understandably so, because it's really terrible the way that works. But the big difference was that the Indians were planning on living there for 1,000 years. And so one of the things I've been thinking about a lot, and this just occurred to me like 2 days ago, so it's still really sort of a young thought, but I want to start making an inventory of what I want this land to look like in 1,000 years. And I want for there to be, I mean, there a lot of it, of course, is based on what was here before. That's 99.99%. But to think about it in terms of, okay, what do I need to do if I want for red-legged frogs to still be here? And, I mean, they were here before, they're native, all that stuff. Okay, what I need to do is I need to not use pesticides, which I don't anyway. I need to help their habitat however I can. There were Port Orford cedar here, and there aren't now. So what can I do to help Port Orford cedar come back? And then that's giving me a framework to really think about what I want to do or not do. And frankly, most of it is not doing anything but letting the land be itself. But there's still, I like that framework of, you know, what if somebody's going to see this land 1,000 years from now, what do I want them to see? And one of the things I want them to see, obviously, is coho salmon and et cetera, et cetera.
That's a very interesting way to look at that. It makes me wonder, too, about recently I had a thought on something similar when I heard that, you know, there's the species have arrived on the planet and gone extinct many times even before, theoretically, man was here. So that too seems to be a natural process. Granted, we certainly don't want humankind to be doing things that are
going to
promoting that.
The process, yeah.
But that also humans try to save species that perhaps are naturally ready to disappear. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think that's really a valid argument, because the that happened over much longer periods of time where entire natural communities, what a lot of people call ecosystems, weren't stressed to the breaking point. And it's one thing when, you know, their time is sort of gone, and it's another when industrial humans are systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet. I mean, the oceans, I'm sure you saw those reports recently. Mm-hmm. You know, the oceans, 90% of the large fish are gone. There's a huge extinction debt, it's called, in Africa, because habitat has been so destroyed. There's probably most of the large primates will be gone in the next 20 years. Most of the large mammals will be gone in 50 or 60. I mean, yes, death is not, it's like comparing death to murder, you know? Sure, we all die, but that doesn't mean that one should go in and machine gun a schoolroom of children, or, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's
Well, I see what you mean. Because the impact of the industrial complex is so great that probably it is affecting everything. Nothing's happening naturally, phasing out anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like there's something called, I'm going to mispronounce this, but I think it's called stochastic events or something like that. That's when a tree falls in a forest and it breaks down stuff and creates this little itty-bitty meadow. Or there might be a fire that will open up a patch of forest, or a big storm comes through and blows down a whole bunch of trees or something. And those events are natural. That's how any sort of natural community, like a forest or a grassland or anything, that's how it regenerates and doesn't just all become this big old forest, but instead you get these little patches that are smaller. And the problem, so the problem is that's what is being done everywhere, is moving every place on the planet to this early stage of succession of, you know, basically making clear cuts, or what the Forest Service sometimes calls temporary meadows, you know, making them everywhere as opposed to it just being this little patch. And what that does, that means when there's just these little patches, that means that the creatures who live in the old growth, they have their habitat. The creatures who live at the edges have their habitat. Creatures who live in the meadows have their habitat. But what we're doing is we're making it, those in power, are making it so that white-tailed deer, for example, love edges. They love the edge between forest and meadow. And so white-tailed deer populations are shooting through the roof because predators have been killed everywhere, and also because there's all that sort of habitat is created. But then you get, spotted owls or whatever other creatures, marbled murrelets, all these creatures who require the old growth, who then can't survive in the edges. So we're creating, not we, they're creating this whole world that only the creatures who can survive at the early stage of succession are doing well. Himalayan blackberries and Scotch broom. It's a really problematical thing. Actually, there's a different direction I would like to go for just a second. Do we have time before the next break?
Sure.
There's lots of frogs in the pond here, and that's one of the things, is just sitting and sort of paying attention. My mom had this idea a couple years ago, which I really like, that I've lived next to this pond for 3 years, and the second winter I was really worried because the frogs seemed late to me, and I hadn't written down the year before, so I've got a calendar that I write down whenever I see something exciting, like the first time the frogs sing, or the first huckleberry blossoms, or, you know, anything like that. If I see something, I'll write it down in there, and so I can know, you know, basically when the frogs start every year. And the first year that I lived here was the year before I lived here. I would come over and see it some, and there were a lot of tadpoles that year. And the next year, not many tadpoles. I was like, oh my gosh, I wonder if it's something having to do with me. And then the next year, a good batch of tadpoles that were pretty much wiped out by back swimmers. And then the point of all this is that this year there were so many tadpoles, and then a bunch of wood ducks, a couple wood ducks came in and they were doing fine. And then I put out some corn for the wood ducks just for the heck of it, and that brought in 7 more wood ducks, and they were eating the tadpoles like crazy. I was thinking, you know, shoot, I probably killed off this year's bunch of tadpoles. But it really made me think, and I'm going to use another nasty word here, but it's okay in real context, which is selective harvest. And that's what the timber industry does, and it's really awful the way the dominant culture does it all the time. But I realize that I'm not talking about what the timber industry does, which is evil and vile, but I think that's what all the natural world does. I think that's what we're all, to use my friend's phrase, hardwired to do, if we really pay attention, is to selectively harvest. Because actually the truth is that the wood ducks did eat some of the tadpoles, but the others just went into hiding. And after the wood ducks left, maybe a week later, they came back and there was still a ton of them. And the point is that, going back to the idea of cooperation in evolution, Well, I want to jump to a different direction for a second, which is I was up in Spokane, Washington, giving a radio interview a while back, a couple of years ago, and I said that...
Derek?
Should we stop?
Yes, because you can't hear the music. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But we're going to go on a break, so may as well stop it right here, and then you can start at the beginning.
Okay.
This is Beyond the Ordinary with Nancy and Elena and Derek Jensen. We'll be right back. MJV Spring products are created and designed to enrich and nurture people's lives with meaning, as reflected by ancient and mystical symbols innate in all humanity. These meaningful symbols adorn golf shirts, sweatshirts, t-shirts, and baseball caps, as well as caftans, coffee mugs, greeting cards, and sultan's pillows. You can easily recognize MJV Spring products by their beautiful ancient symbol designs and excellent quality. The designs include the mystical seven-pointed star, the wings of Isis, the eye of Horus, the magical unicorn, and more. Shop anywhere in the world at mjvspring.com. MJV Spring is without doubt beyond the ordinary.
MastersConnection.com, a website where people can buy and sell products and services. www.MastersConnection.com. We have a bulletin board and send weekly newsletters, and subscription is free. www.MastersConnection.com, where people can connect with each other.
Give your body the life, energy, nutrition you need with the Rainforest Health Packs, the fastest, easiest, and most cost-effective way to experience the power of the Amazon herbs is to start with the Rainforest Health Pack.
It was carefully designed to give you the essential nutrients your body needs to feel the benefits of vibrant health and vitality. Experience for yourself the richest concentration of healing life energy on the planet.
The health pack includes Illumination, a complete formula for whole body health. Sumacasan, for youthful energy and vitality. Aquazan, increase energy and strengthen the immune system. Fiberzan, to maintain a healthy intestinal tract. A free bottle of stevia, a natural herb 300 times sweeter than sugar. And of course, the delicious Shipibo Treasure Tea, plus an additional free product of your choice.
For more information, call 800-551-2933. That's 800-551-2933. Back. This is Beyond the Ordinary with Nancy and Elena. Our guest is Derek Jensen, author of many extraordinary books. And you were just shifting to another thought there, Derek. Go ahead with that.
Well, it has to do with this whole thing of so-called selective harvest, which is I was in Spokane, Washington, and doing a radio interview, and the guy asked me, so... Indians, we didn't ask, he said Indians exploited salmon too. I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. There's a difference. And he said, what's the difference? And I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew that was kind of crap, but it was the only thing I could think of. And and it's true so far as it goes, but I knew there was something missing. And I went out that afternoon, and I was sitting next to this tree and just sort of really asking, so what is the predator-prey relationship? And what's the exchange that happens? And the tree that I was sitting next to, the coyote tree from the language, is really gave me the answer, which is that when you consume the flesh of another, and this is true whether it's plant or plant or animal or anything, when you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I eat a salmon, I am now responsible for the continuation of that run and the health of the river.
Hmm.
And this is true not only on sort of a moral level, but it's true on a physical level, because if you don't, then you're not going to eat salmon for very long.
Right.
Exactly.
And so the wood ducks, I have no doubt, if they're going to survive here, what they need to do is they need to take only some of the
frogs.
Tadpoles, and then they need to go somewhere else, and they can eat the tadpoles there. And then they can, meanwhile, poop out the tadpoles from here. They can poop them somewhere to move the nutrients around. And, I mean, that's how the whole symphony works together, and I'm not saying that no creature ever overeats its habitat, but those that do then don't survive. I mean, the only way you can survive is by maintaining that bargain of taking responsibility for the continuation of the other community. And that's helped. I mean, that's one of the reasons I started raising chickens in the first place, is because if I'm going to kill something, if I'm going to eat something, I needed to take responsibility for the killing, because killing is actually very difficult for me. For crying out loud, I carry mosquitoes outside usually. I was talking to another tree about that. I got in an argument with somebody about toilet paper one time, because he was saying that because if anybody uses toilet paper, they are as responsible for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser. And I was just saying that that's nonsense, that the culpability I have for deforestation isn't because I use toilet paper, it's because I allow Weyerhaeuser to continue its existence, frankly. And then he responded by saying, well, when you say, so what, you use toilet paper, a lot of my tree friends start, quaking and get very agitated. This was an email exchange, and I wrote back saying, is this hyperbolic? I mean, are you just making this up, or is this literally true? He never responded. But the point is, I thought, okay, so he asked, so I may as well ask. So I asked some trees here, so do you mind if I use toilet paper? And the answer I got from the tree was very interesting, which is, you're an animal. You consume things. Get over it.
That's wisdom.
I'm wondering, too, what his alternative would be.
Let's not even
go there.
No. Well, actually, I do want to go there for a second. I've been thinking about that a lot, because if I don't have, if I'm not going to use a toilet, let's say I'm going to go ahead and go to the bathroom outside, which there's only one person living here, so I can do that without, sort of overwhelming. It's quite a good thing, because, this is moving the nutrients outside instead of down into the septic tank. But I've been thinking, I've been really paying attention. There's a lot of leaves that are really nice and soft. And, mm-hmm. Why do I need, as long as I'm going to use the toilet, I'm going to use toilet paper so I don't mess up the system there. But if I were to start pooping outside, I may as well just use these leaves, because you don't have to deforest, blah, blah, blah. So it's actually not a bad thing, I think.
Well, that's a very time-honored tradition.
Mm-hmm.
That's,
well,
indigenous
that's been around
people
for a lot
know
longer.
That, sure.
It's been around a lot longer than toilets.
Yes. But you were talking about selective harvesting, and I think that one of the things where that is very necessary is in people's brains, because a lot good would come from doing some selective harvesting and getting rid of old attitudes, old notions, judgments, everything else, and start thinking as if we are going to be here 1,000 years, which this culture doesn't do.
Yeah, there's other phrase I really love, which is, I don't know who said this, but somebody did, that unquestioned assumptions are the real authority of any culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. And it doesn't matter to me what, I mean, I was talking to this guy in Colorado several months ago who was total conservative, but we actually had quite a good conversation because he thinks, and he's not just an unthinking conservative. And I have a lot less patience for, I don't have much patience for dogma. It just doesn't interest me. And I think it's really dangerous, this sort of unthinking, you know. That's one of the things I really wanted to accomplish with A Language Older Than Words. I didn't want to convince people that non-humans, that there's these conversations going on all the time. What I wanted to do was to make it so they didn't just have the default being that no communication takes place. And then I want for them to figure out for themselves. I mean, somebody asked me once at one of my talks, if you could have 10,000 people do your bidding, what would you have them do? And I said, well, I'd sure as hell have them not listen to me. And he said, well, that's a real cop-out because 10,000 people could take out a lot of dams. And I said, well, that's all great, but if you really want to know what to do, and this was in Texas, in Austin, Texas, and I said, if you really want to know what to do, you should go down to Barton Springs, and that's a very important, very imperiled springs in Austin. You should go down to Barton Springs, you should sit there, and you should ask the springs what it wants. And, you know, wherever you live, just ask the land what it wants, and it'll tell you. And this has to do both with listening to the land and then also with learning how to think for yourself, which is something, of course, we're systematically taught not to do. Which, by the way, I've got a book coming out next spring also on education. If you remember the part in A Language Older Than Words where I talked about like 10 pages or so on when I taught at Eastern Washington University,
yes.
I expanded that into 200 pages.
And what is that title?
That one's called Walking on Water on Reading, Writing, and Revolution.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really happy with that. And I'm also writing a book right now on FBI and corporate surveillance techniques, which is the scariest thing I've written. And then I'm also writing my big book, and that'll be out next spring. And I'm also writing my big book, which will maybe out in the next fall if I can finish it in time, on how to take down civilization. And then one more thing, if I can go ahead and say other things that are going on, is I'm putting out another CD, and this one actually, my first CD, Stand Up Tragedy, I produced it, which means it sounds like I produced it. I'm not a sound producer. It sounds like a bootleg, and it's a good bootleg, so it's all fine. The material's good. The sound quality is like a bootleg. It's fine. But the new one's being produced by an actual honest-to-goodness record producer, and I just last night heard his draft of CD one. It's going to be a triple CD of the first CD, actually the second CD. And it's great. I'm so happy with it. It made me very, very happy.
Good.
And that should be out in, I don't know, probably September or something. And that's going to be called The Other Side of Darkness, which is what I wanted to call the book, The Culture of Make-Believe, but didn't fly.
Huh. I think The Culture of Make-Believe is a very descriptive title.
Yeah.
It's good.
I didn't like it at first, but I grew to like it a lot.
Yeah. You are also going to be on, when is it, August 9th, you're going to participate in Break the Chains Conference. That's very close to us, you know, for all our local listeners. That's in Eugene, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. That's at the University of Oregon, I believe. And there's going to be a ton of people there. Ward Churchill is there the first night. And, oh my gosh, I don't remember who else is there. There's a former Black Panther is there.
Your talk is on Saturday.
Saturday afternoon, 4
Saturday
or something
4,
like that.
Yeah, 4 to 6 p.m.?
Something like that.
And then you're going to go to the bookstore so people can talk to you.
Yeah,
person.
Well, I'll be doing a short talk at the bookstore because the bookstore wanted me to do something, and I didn't want to compete with everybody else there, you know, draw people away from other events. But it ends up that right after my talk, 4 to 6 or whatever, there was a break for dinner anyway before the evening's event. So it works out perfectly. I mean, as long as people either, A, don't want to eat, or, B, just want to bring their food with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all great.
That's a good opportunity to meet you and have a chat.
Mm-hmm.
So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, Derek. What thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners?
Oh, is there another question you want to ask?
I love doing that. See if you can go blank, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're. What else on how you communicate with other critters? You know, when you say ask the forest or ask the fish or whatever, how do people hear the answer?
A lot of times, I mean, I was thinking about this yesterday that, you know, some people could, you know, maybe some people could that could cost some credibility with me saying that, you know, the tree said this. But what's really the difference between saying it occurred to me or the tree said this? I mean, it's a fundamental difference in terms of happened. But where do people's thoughts come from? Where do they think they come from? Do they think that they make everything up themselves? Or,
well,
you know,
yeah, that's a basic fallacy. Is that your phone doing something?
I don't think so.
Okay.
All right.
What were you going to say?
We're getting beeps.
Go ahead.
Anyway, mind is unlimited, and it's not private in our heads, so everything is speaking. And you just have to get in the flow of it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And dreams, frankly, are one really good way that we haven't. That's another thing maybe we can talk about another time is the whole, I mentioned in my book something I call the dream giver, which I consider a real entity. Some of my Indian friends tell me that animals give dreams to us, but that's not what I thought. I certainly don't think it's just the unconscious sort of working stuff out. Oh, I know that's not the case because I've had dreams. I've had leakage a lot where I have other people's dreams. I don't know if that happens to you.
Well, Nancy and I have had dreams that are the same dream,
mm-hmm.
you know, but we're off on an adventure, both participating.
Right. That's all. I mean, with the risk of getting too woo, I mean, that's all very real.
Well, everything is very woo. I mean, there's magic everywhere. And that leads me to the quote for today, which very appropriate for that. This is from Wayne Dyer. If you find yourself believing that you must always be the way you have always been, you are arguing against growth. And we are arguing against magic when we think that all of this cannot happen. And if that causes disbelief or a loss of credibility, you think, to what you say, then that is the loss to the person thinking that way because they stay in the same place.
And that's why we bring guests such as yourself to the program, because then it helps give everybody another perspective to think differently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because they are all perspectives, and even the ones we don't agree with are valid, because then we can understand what it is that we want and what is worth fighting for too,
right.
As you so well do. So I'm glad that you, in the beginning, as you stated in a language older than words, you gave up the idea of going out to blow down dams to take another
attack. Oh, I haven't
attack.
Given that idea up.
Derek. Well, we'll talk. Anyway, that is just about it. You had a lovely, lovely thing to come back with us, and we appreciate it, as do our listeners. And thank you, Derek.
Thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners.